Welcome to Nature's Medicine for Modern Living, a people and plants dialogue hosted by the Sophie Health Team with founder Kaveh Mamari, herbalist Pamela Spence, and evangelist Vincent Boone. Together, we explore the ancient world of plant medicine and reimagine it for the connected age, and hear from our community of international pioneers who are validating this new paradigm and improving how we feel, sleep, and cope with daily stresses naturally. Sophie.health, reconnecting people and plants.
Well, a very warm welcome to the show this week. Thanks for tuning in to join our conversations about managing stress and the common issues of poor sleep and anxiety, the Sophie way. We're excited to bring you guest speakers who have inspired us, people from the world of medicine, plants, and beyond, to examine different approaches to health and well-being. And our hope is that by having these conversations between people who would normally never meet, we can showcase new approaches and open up new ideas of healthcare, some that are pillars of the Sophie.health system and can support us all in new and profound ways.
If this is your first time tuning into the show, you can find out all about the Sophie.health mission by visiting our Listen on Demand page on the UK Health Radio website. Episode one explains kind of like who we are and what we do. And from there, you can see the distinguished list of distinguished guests we've got. We've had the pleasure of interviewing each week various different topics, from wild food to keyhole surgery, from managing your energy to compassion in medicine. At Sophie, we have a very special vision for health, and we have created a combination of plant extracts, an app, and an online community to support people through stressful times.
Last week in episode 19, we welcomed Sophie psychologist Dr. Nikki O'Brien back to the show to talk about how the support of our peers can be incredibly helpful when we are dealing with health challenges, how peer research is taking off in a big way, and how the language and even colours used in our Sophie app were carefully chosen to support our Sophie users in the best way we can. If you missed that show, make sure you go to our Listen on Demand page to catch up.
So before we introduce you to this week's guest speaker, regular listeners will know that we've created a page especially for UK Health Radio listeners who would like to join the Sophie community. And we have a special discount code for you, which is Radio50, and it gives you 50% discount off the price of a Sophie pod. You can find all this information at join.sophie.health/radio, or just go to the UK Health Radio homepage, click on our banner, and it'll get you directly there. And now, a little bit about today's guest speaker, Dr. David Kasserey, Professor of Palliative Care.
David is a palliative care physician and health services researcher whose work focuses on improving systems of care for people with serious life-threatening illnesses. He is a professor of medicine at Duke University and the chief of palliative care in Duke Health. He is the author of more than 100 articles in journals, including the Journal of the American Medical Association and the New England Journal of Medicine. And his writing has appeared in print and online in Salon, Esquire, Discover, Newsweek, The New York Times, and Wired. He is a recipient of the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers, the highest honor given by the US government to researchers in the early stages of their careers.
Not only does David write medical papers, David is also an author of 3 books. The most recent is Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, published in 2015 by Penguin Random House. But he also writes novels, including the ethical Chiang Mai Detective Agency series. What a perfect example of a right and left brain hemisphere balance right there. What a bio. Evie, what are your thoughts on meeting David today?
I mean, wow, David, your bio really speaks for itself there. Today, I'm pretty, very much interested to hear about your contributions within the palliative care kind of system. I only recently found out what this meant, and I think it's such an incredible cause to be spending your time to research and ultimately aid in trying to, return individuals suffering from such a serious illness back to a more comfortable state in their lives. I'm sure many of our listeners and pioneers here today either know someone that is struggling with like these distressing symptoms or even struggle themselves. And I think we can all agree that there is such a gap in the medical field for helping individuals suffering from these life-threatening illnesses, especially focusing on the relief of these symptoms. And I think it's really inspiring how you are focusing your time, effort, and expertise into this field to ultimately aim to kind of improve individuals' lives really struggling with quite isolating symptoms, you know, to ease them through such tough times. I'm also really interested on your views on, you know, possible frustrations with our current mainstream like access of medicine, as this is once again a topic that I'm sure our listeners and pioneers, including myself, have had to deal with, you know, medical systems failing us. Therefore, I'm curious as to what you believe is the way forward to kind of alleviate these frustrations. So yeah, I can't wait to hear what you have to say.
David, lovely to have you join us on the program. You know, we all know you're extremely busy, so thank you for taking the time out of your day to be with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Where should we start?
Yeah, with such an amazing CV and all the things that you've done. You know, I think it'd be interesting, I guess, to start off with that, you know, as a professor of, you know, palliative care, how you got to join Sophie, right? How did the two connect, Sophie and yeah, kind of like your work that you've done so far?
Sure. I mean, this is going back a ways, I guess. But it's worth saying a little bit more about palliative care, because that may make the connection make a little bit more sense. You know, as Evie was saying, palliative care is really all about improving quality of life for people with serious illnesses. And some of that's, as she said, symptom management. We spend a lot of time managing pain and other symptoms. We also provide other forms of support, emotional, spiritual support. And then, you know, also a lot of help with decision making. And so that's my way of saying palliative care really is a very holistic discipline. I think medicine often aspires to be holistic, doesn't always achieve that, except in some pockets. But that's really been ingrained in palliative care's DNA since it was created. And I should say, back when I started, I won't date myself by saying when that was, but there were no formal fellowships. There were no formal programs. I think we were all kind of making it up as we go along. So the combination of being in a specialty that's very holistic, that puts patients and families at the center of care, and I guess being part of a specialty that didn't exist before I got into it, and having to build it along with a lot of other people, by the way, I think gave me more of an entrepreneurial spirit. So when, you know, Karen, Kavya and I started talking way back when, I really saw Sophie as almost a nice extension of what we do in palliative care, which is to really focus as much as we can on how people feel. A lot of medicine is about MRI scans and CTs and lab tests. And there's some of that in palliative care, but a lot of palliative care really relies on how people feel. And we take that as our central reason for being in a room with a patient and our marching orders when we leave the room. Doesn't really matter what the labs show necessarily or what the CAT scan is looking like. If people are feeling better, you know, we're doing our job. And if they're not, then we're not. And so this idea that Kav and I talked about years ago was putting both some control, but also some information in the hands of patients, taking away to some degree the lab tests and the CAT scans and MRIs, and giving people the information that they need at their fingertips, literally, to help them visualize and understand whether they're feeling better, how they're feeling better, and to take stock as a way of helping them to take control over their own healthcare. So that's a long-winded way of saying I'm not sure Sophie's so different than palliative care. Maybe the next iteration or the next generation of palliative care, but I hope that's the way that a lot of medicine is going.
Yeah. No, I can see that kind of crossover. And what it was kind of like, you know, you meeting Cave at an event, or had you actually heard about Sophie before? Cafe as usual, you know, just waltzing in and you know, having fantastic conversations and getting everyone to join in with his dreams.
Yeah, that's a pretty good description of Cave, I think. No, I did a TED talk on medical cannabis a while back, and I think Kaveh saw that and reached out. And lucky for me, I actually paid attention to his emails. As you can imagine, especially after giving a TED talk, a lot of emails flood my inbox, many of which are indecipherable or just bizarre. But Kaveh's caught my attention, and that led to a collaboration on actually a progenitor of Sophie, a different project that kind of morphed into Sophie over time. So it's led to both some interesting ideas and then a longstanding relationship and collaboration with Kaveh and many other folks on the team.
It really reminds me when you're talking about the holistic care of palliative care. Before we spoke, David, about this in preparation of the show, I'd never really thought about how palliative care might be different to, you know, medicine in another way. And it was when you said to me, when you are, you know, at the end stages of life, your blood pressure reading doesn't matter nearly as much as how you're feeling. And that I really took that away. I had never thought about it that way. And when you were just talking there about the amount of decisions and the literally life-changing decisions people are having to make, and that holistic way of stepping them through it, kind of reminds me of the show we did with Professor Jan Bonhoeffer, who talks about bringing compassion back into healthcare and holding space for people and, you know, really getting to know the patients. It sounds much more holistic than how we might imagine.
Yeah, it certainly is. Again, it's something we strive for. It's, you know, having compassion and longstanding relationships and really investing the time and emotional energy to be present for patients is difficult. It's emotionally difficult, it's wearing, and it's just physically, pragmatically difficult for a lot of primary care providers who, at least in the United States where I practice, who have 10 minutes to spend with patients and see 30 or 40 patients a day. There's really not much space there for being present. You're just trying to put out fires. So, you know, in palliative care, we have the luxury of spending more time with patients. But even then, you know, sometimes we meet patients in the hospital in the last days of life. And we're really, I wouldn't say we can't establish relationships, but we're, I feel like, under a lot of pressure to connect quickly because we don't really have much time. We don't have the luxury of a year or two of getting to know a patient and her daughters and her husband. So we can help them make decisions. We really need to get to a point of, if not intimacy, then at least meaningful connection in the first 5 or 10 minutes, because sometimes we only have hours or days if we're lucky. Yeah. But I think it is something that medicine aspires to. And if I think Evie alluded to this before, a lot of frustrations to medicine, but and man, that's a really, at least in the United States healthcare system, it's a long list. But I think one of the biggest ones is what is too often a disconnection between healthcare providers and patients. You know, we have a lot of healthcare providers who are working shifts and patients who are bouncing from one healthcare provider to another. And I think my academic work actually is to try to figure out how we can create more of a sense of connection when time is limited and attention is scattered. It's not easy, but I think it's a challenge that's worth solving.
I feel like it's one of the roles that, as a medical herbalist, the way that I practice, that people talk to me a lot, my patients talk to me a lot about the fact that they miss the continuity of the family doctor, the family GP that knew everybody, you know, that knew your family situations, that you'd been to see for 20 years. So I've been in practice now for 15, 16, 17 years. And some of my patients are there from the beginning. You know, some of them I saw through school and now they're parents themselves. And there is something about that longevity of connection, which it seems very difficult to find in, you know, in the medical establishments now, that we're always moving. So that ability to connect deeply with someone is a huge gift to them, I think. And what was it about Sophie that you thought might work? You know, but we talked before about the fact that some people were a bit resistant to some pharmaceutical interventions. And what was it you thought about Sophie that you thought would actually work for people to help them?
Yeah, I wasn't totally sure it would work, but one of the, we never are we?
No, we're not. We are not.
Yeah, whether you're cooking a new meal for your family or coming up with a new grant idea, we're always like, I'm pretty sure, but maybe not. I think one of the big attractions for me is because I traffic in symptoms and quality of life. They're sort of slightly whiffy outcomes. And there are plenty of days that I wake up and I'm jealous of my oncologist colleagues who can tell whether chemotherapy is working because the hemoglobin is up and the CAT scan looks better, or at least not a whole lot worse, and they're objective measures. Whereas when I recommend a new medication for somebody's nausea, the best we can do often is, how are you feeling? Is it better? Yeah, I think so. You think so? You're not sure? Well, yeah, I think I've had some better moments than I did before. Well, should we keep trying that medication? Well, yeah, let's try it for another couple of days and see what happens. And so it seems like we're always, with some exceptions, in this no man's land of, is this working or not? You know, which means sometimes we commit people to long courses of medications that aren't helping because we don't have a way of, you know, there's no blood test for pain and there's no CT scan for nausea. But one of the appeals to me of Sophie was being able to help people to visualize their own progress and helping them to track, are they really feeling better? And to look back at those results and help them to make decisions with visualizations and data about whether some new modality or change in lifestyle or behavior is actually helping them. Because I think we're pretty smart creatures as human beings, but we're subject to all sorts of biases that make it incredibly difficult for us to say definitively, yes, I'm doing better on this new treatment, on this new plan.
It is really hard because it's so subjective. It's so in the moment. Did you have a good sleep last night? Yeah, well, you maybe feel better about your pain levels today and you can do more. And if you had a really bad night's sleep, maybe you feel like you're overwhelmed and you just really can't continue with this. I often say to my patients, the only thing we can ever do with medicine that we can't measure the outcome of the test, like what I work with, is all you can do is offer the body medicine and it will tell you in symptoms, you know, how it's doing. You know, so if your body is responding and you're feeling better, you will know because your symptom picture is better. And it's another reason why I write down everything that my patients say. I try to write it in their own language, because then we go back through. I did that with someone this morning. We went back 6 months because it was really unsure whether she was getting better or not. We thought maybe, but when we went back and read the language she was using at that time consistently week after week, And she heard those words again. She was like, oh, wow, I'm not anywhere near there now, you know. But, you know, it's not a definite way of doing things. It's all very subjective. And I think what Sophie really excited in me was the fact that we could come in and see actual data there. And that's fantastic. David, you mentioned in your TED, you did a TED talk on medical cannabis, which I really, really enjoyed. And you talked there, but you told this great story there about, you know, how you discovered that private clinics were giving patients a whole different experience of healthcare than most interactions are with the medical world. Can you talk a bit about that? Because it was such a great example.
Yeah, it depends on how much time we have. There are enormous differences. And I think some of them are superficial, to be honest. You know, the cannabis industry is a big profit maker. And so they can afford, dispensaries and producers can afford to create really beautiful clinics that look more like spas. And so, you know, that's part of it. But putting that aside, because I think it is superficial, I think the biggest change for me that I think medicine could take as a lesson, or the biggest lesson I saw in visiting a lot of dispensaries, is the way that medical cannabis works, at least in the United States, is a little bit crazy, a little bit oddly regulated because laws change from state to state. But the advantage to that is that there's a lot of experimentation going on, and a lot of dispensaries and producers are trying new things and new strategies of engaging patients. And in the process, they're learning a lot. And I think a lot of those lessons, to answer your question, really focus on ways to give patients more control over their own health. And that's particularly relevant to my patient population, where a lot of people with advanced serious illnesses are dependent on healthcare. They're dependent on the healthcare system, doctors and nurses in particular. And they've lost a lot of their ability to function normally in their eyes. And they've lost a sense of dignity and self-control. And being able to manage therapies without relying on a healthcare provider to write a prescription really is empowering and liberating for particularly my patients, but a lot of people who seek medical cannabis therapy. Without the trappings of healthcare and without a lot of the lab tests and other things, it gives patients a chance really to interact with their own bodies and with healthcare and to say, I feel better, I don't feel better. And it puts control back in their hands to try something new if what they're using doesn't work, without having to go through intermediaries of insurance companies and doctors and nurses and clinic visits. And I think that that really is liberating for a lot of people.
And I guess that's where Sophie fits in, you know, to that as well. Exactly. It's something that people can go and do for themselves, isn't it? You've spoken about that in conversations we've had in the past, where there's something empowering about being able to go forward and, you know, and choose to do this without waiting for the prescription or the permission to do it. You can opt to do it yourself, which is interesting, because that does change the relationship with the medicine then, and with your own healthcare as well. Interesting. Some really great insights there. Thank you so much, David. We've only just started to get into this conversation, I know, and we'd love to continue with you. So please do stay with us, and we'll be right back after this commercial break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back. A quick reminder before we dive back into the conversation to visit our special landing page for UK HR listeners at join.sophie.health/radio for all the information you need to join us and your special 50% discount code, radio50. Now, before the break, we heard Dr. David Kasserat talk about his connection with Sophie and how he got involved with us from palliative care and you know, the fact that there's a real focus on how people feel to, you know, switching that to Sophie, where we're really trying to put some control back into the hands of patients and give them information as well to help them understand how they're feeling and when they're feeling better. So palliative care is very much around compassion, long-standing relationships where possible, and being present with patients. Which is very hard in our current care system. Doctors kind of have, you know, on average about 10 minutes per patient. So, you know, and that's the beauty of palliative care, where sometimes you do have the luxury of time. So where you can look at whether things are working, when people are feeling unwell or nauseous or any of those kind of things. So yeah, the real appeal of Sophie was allowing people to visualize and give them data, so they can kind of, like, you know, find out whether something is working or not. So David, having now worked with Sophie and having gone through, you know, the various different trials that we've done with our pioneers, and having, you know, kind of obviously developed the system, we've made our tweaks and got it better and better and better. I'm sort of wondering, what are the kind of, like, lessons that you have learned from working with Sophie and seeing that, you know, being produced to an actual app where you can record, you know, how things are going for you? How could you say that could be applied in the current kind of, like, mainstream system of medicine? And are there other, you know, kind of, like, real lessons from Sophie that you think, yeah, no, we should really apply that to what we're doing currently?
Yeah, sure. It's a great question, and it's a huge question. Maybe I'll take a stab at it and then give other folks on the panel a chance to fill the places that I've missed. I mean, I think one of my big frustrations with mainstream healthcare right now is, and this is kind of a double-edged sword, but a lot of advances in healthcare, a lot of ability now to relieve suffering and to improve quality of life and to extend life that we didn't have access to even a year or two ago. But what that's meant is that medicine has become so, so complicated, that not only is it difficult for typical patients really to have a true sense of what's going on with their healthcare, what's working, what's not, where the trajectory of illness is taking them, but it also leads to sort of, I don't know, what I see in my patients sometimes is kind of a learned helplessness, in the sense that there are just too many lab tests and too many CAT scans and too many often conflicting, frankly, expert opinions. And because things are so technologically advanced and logistically complex, I think there's a tendency of a lot of people, particularly those who face serious illnesses, at that point in their lives when they really need to be more focused on their healthcare, they really need to take more control over their healthcare. It's become bewildering and almost impossible to do that. And just getting to see a healthcare provider requires all of the mental agility that a lot of people have in the setting of a serious illness. And so the reaction, I think, for a lot of us is just to rely on healthcare providers to ask for the right questions, get the right tests, interpret those tests, and make recommendations. And I think one of the big picture attractions that Sophie's had for me is that it gives people a chance to take some of that back. Sophie is not about interpreting a spinal MRI image. Fortunately, I'm glad we didn't take that on. What we're after is understanding and interpreting results or qualities that are simpler in some respects, but much more complex in others, like how we feel. And I think that may be Sophie's biggest contribution, being able to provide some clarity of mental image with numbers to back it up that describe how we're doing now compared to how we were doing a month ago, how we're doing on this particular preparation of valerian versus how we were doing before we started it. As a starting point for conversation, giving people kind of the same thing that they would get from going to get an MRI scan. These are the data, these are the results, in as objective a form as we can imagine, to get patients more on a level playing field so they're not waiting patiently or sometimes less patiently for healthcare providers to give them data and recommendations. So that to me is one of the coolest things that Sophie's been able to do.
It reminds me of a conversation we had with Stuart Fletcher, who we were talking about earlier, and he was saying that from his healthcare systems way of looking at the world at the moment, that complexity in healthcare right now means that all resources are utterly stretched just trying to firefight. And that if we're ever going to step into any kind of preventative care, which everyone wants to do, we all know it makes sense, but if we're going to do that, it actually has to be organizations from the outside of mainstream healthcare that come in and do that, because there's just no headspace. You know, there's no, his point was that the you're not going to get that kind of preventative work going on in the mainstream healthcare system because there's no headspace. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. There's no headspace. I think there's no headspace for the typical primary care provider. I think that's fair. If you're seeing somebody with diabetes and heart disease and lung disease and what may be early dementia, but you're not really sure, you have 10 minutes to manage all of that. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to imagine carving out even 30 seconds for discussing a plan of weight loss, smoking cessation, stress management, or anything else. I do think that's that area. I was hedging initially because that area is being taken over by other groups, whether that's startups equivalent to Sophie or foundations that provide grant funding, government initiatives to enhance wellness, improve exercise, and so on. But I think you're right. If we leave that to the healthcare system, and specifically to healthcare providers, we'll be waiting a long time. And to be fair, I think a lot of healthcare providers would love to do that. And a lot of healthcare providers have gone into their specialties because they really want to engage in preventive health. So I think this is not a conscious choice that healthcare providers are making. I think, as you point out, we are stretched very thin, and we do what we can. And smoking cessation, for instance, is important, but managing this acute onset chest pain is more important. So we do that, and then hope that we can get to preventive work at some point in the future.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't feel like a choice that's made on purpose. It very much feels like, you know, a firefighting situation. But I do really notice, working with people on both sides of the pond, I do notice a big difference between, you talked about US healthcare system earlier, that I find that when I'm working with people there, there's a lot more going on in terms of preventative healthcare if you have the insurance. So the big thing, you know, for us here in the UK, of course, we pay through our taxes and everybody turns up wherever they need to, and they don't pay any more at that point, you know. So it's free at the point of delivery is our healthcare service. And what I notice is a lot of the annual checks that you're getting in the US, a lot of my patients, we're not getting them in the UK. So I do feel like the US is a bit ahead in terms of preventative healthcare if you have the right insurance is the one thing. If you don't have that, then not. But if you do have that, then people are getting annual, you know, thyroid panels done and hormone panels done. And for here, that just doesn't feel like it's happening at all.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned insurance because, I mean, whenever somebody asks me about the benefits as I see them of a national health insurance program, it's almost universal that in the last couple of days, I've seen a patient without health insurance whose health has declined, bad diagnoses were missed because of a lack of health insurance. So without weighing in on the pros and cons of a national health insurance program, if you don't have health insurance, that certainly looks like a very, very good system. And there are many of my patients who are not alive now because they didn't have access to insurance and probably would be if they lived in a country where that was available.
Yeah.
Different topic for another
topic. Yeah, different and very political topic, obviously, but it does impact the people that, you know, and the ways that they're accessing healthcare. And it's interesting, just think about even that lack of insurance, meaning that things are not picked up, meaning that potentially, you know, it's not just about healthcare at that moment, but meaning that maybe down the line, things weren't picked up and things maybe at a more advanced stage. So let's then talk a bit about efficacy. So we had Dr. Nikki O'Brien on the show last week, and that was her second visit with us. The first time she came, so Nikki O'Brien, for anyone who didn't listen in to last week's show, she is the Sophie psychologist, and she helped to build the app. And we talked in the first show when she came to see us, we unpacked this N of one idea behind the research that Sophie does, which is really all about embracing change. And it was so refreshing to hear about, instead of trying to fit us all into kind of one size fits all model, that actually the Sophie app was about embracing change. And Vincent, I think you'll probably remember in the community when we first started running the Pioneer programs, people would say, they would message us in the treehouse and they would say, okay, I'm about to start, but I also take vitamin D. Shall I start my vitamin D? Like, you know, I want my dog for 20 minutes in the morning, but I want to do 40 minutes. Can I do that? Is that going to affect our results, right? And it was so great to be able to say, you do you, because the way that we've built the app and the way that we're collecting the data based on the N of one idea is that we are really embracing change. So I just wonder, when we're talking about efficacy, David, and how you would approach that as a clinician. So what was it about the way Sophie was doing this that was enticing to you? You know, because loads of people will talk to you, I'm sure, about, oh, I went and bought this herb or that herb. You know, you work in a very different world to the one that I work in. And it's not always believable. So what was it about what we were doing and how we were doing it that was really interesting for you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the cool things about Sophie is, as we've developed it over the last couple of years, is, as you say, that focus on what does this intervention mean for this individual? And, you know, I come from and still live in the world of big scale healthcare, where we really talk a lot about means and medians. So a new treatment comes out and on average, it improves blood pressure by 10 points, or it reduces anxiety by 1 point on a 12-point scale or whatever. And we usually take those results and act on them, realizing, I guess, in the back of our minds that we actually don't know whether this new drug or modality is going to work for this patient in front of us. But we know that on average, for most people who may or may not be like this person sitting in front of us, this drug works. So we're going to recommend it, which isn't bad science, by the way. I'm not denigrating it. It's what we've got. But the more we realize that people are very, very different, either because of social factors or environment or diet or genetic factors. We all have different facial features and we all have different genetic features, which means our receptors to various medications differ, the enzymes that break down those medications differ. And of the people on this call right now, we would all respond, I think, somewhat differently to various drugs. And the cool thing about Sophie is that without getting into genetic testing or any of the biochemistry, because we don't need to, it recognizes that you take four or five people in a room, they all use valerian for sleep, you'll have four or five different results. Which again is not to jettison all of the large scale randomized control trials that are going on, but to realize that that's one way of looking at the truth. And the other way is a much smaller scale and of one design in which we're focused not on whether this works for people on average, or even whether this works for people like you, but whether this works for you. And I think that's one of the coolest things about Sophie, in my view.
Do you think of plants differently now? Plant medicine, had you come across herbal medicine much in the past? And has it given you a new kind of focus on it?
Yeah, I'm guessing that the politically correct answer to that question, since we're on this show, is
there
yes,
is no politically correct answer to that question.
I'm going to go on the record and say, no, not really, because I've worked for so long in the cannabis space where a lot of the same issues are there. There's not a whole lot of data. It's a lot about whether this works for you, a lot of inter-individual variability, and a lot of complexity. I mean, when somebody uses medical cannabis for a medical purpose, they're not using one molecule, they're using thousands of molecules. And I think part of the challenge is unpacking which of those molecules is having what effect. Keeping in mind that there may be an effect there that's buried because two molecules are balancing each other out. So I came to Sophie and plant-based medicine from the perspective of medical cannabis, which I think led me to be a little bit more open to what plant-based medicine offers. I'm not sure that's typical of other physicians I work with. I'd rather not speculate on that. But for me, this wasn't a huge sea change.
Yeah, that I think that's probably is quite different that you came from it, you know, into cannabis first and then in that way. So for example, you know, I'm a big fan of telling my students, you know, there's some of the chemicals that are in plants that we don't even have names for yet. So we don't know whether they're working or, you know, what their synergy is within that mix. And but what I have really enjoyed about working with Sophie is that, you know, people like yourself and myself would normally never have met and never have been able to have these conversations. And that's one of the things we talked about a lot on the show and the people that we've had on here as guests is that, you know, we're bringing people together who I would never normally have had this kind of conversation with you where we could have unpacked that kind of thing. When Jonathan Sacchi was here as well, and when Professor Jan Bonhoeffer was here, you know, these are paths that don't normally cross. And I think it helps us to be better practitioners when we can have these open conversations. So we're really grateful for that. So thank you so much for being with us today. And please do stay with us for the rest of the show. After the commercial break, we'll be meeting my Herbal Hero of the Week. You'll have some thoughts from Evie on the discussion today. And of course, we'll have final thoughts from Vincent as well on what we've been chatting about. We look forward to being back with you right after this commercial break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Nature's Medicine for Modern Living, a people and plant dialogue hosted by Sophie.health on UK Health Radio. And now it's time for our Herbal Hero of the Week. And this week, I'm going to turn our attention to some trees. So we've already spoken about one tree that's used in herbal medicine and is on Sophie's list of plants, and that's the limeflower, with a great history of being used to help reduce anxiety and improve sleep. I'm not sure whether you think about trees when you're considering herbal medicine, but I certainly do. And my dispensary is full of herbal tinctures made from trees. Of course, there's famous willow bark, which is used as a mild painkiller. We also use birch, as well as tapping the sap as a spring tonic. And of course, maple sap is really famous as well. So coming up over the next few weeks and months in the Northern Hemisphere, we'll have a number of trees that will be available to harvest sustainably to make herbal medicines. Hawthorn and elder are amongst those. And of course, in the UK, if you've got anything to do with foraging, you'll all be checking out where the blackthorn is right now so that we all know where to find the sloes in the autumn to make our sloe gin. But today, one of the first and possibly the showiest trees to appear in the spring is the magnolia tree. And it's unusual because the really beautiful pink and white flowers appear on the tree now before the leaves, which come later. So it's very striking and it's pretty difficult to mistake for anything else. Now, I'm sure Mo Wild, who we had on just before Christmas and talked, but she's the herbalist who lived on wild food for a year. She will know about magnolia and probably be looking for it because foragers love the petals because they taste just like ginger. They are absolutely delicious when you add them to stir fries for the few weeks that they're in bloom. And there are absolutely tons of other really lovely recipes that you can make with them. You just need to do a quick search online for those. They're not native to the UK or the US, so they're usually planted as garden specimens. So be sure to ask your nice neighbours before harvesting. But I usually find that a trade of something really nice made with the plant works really well. So when I came on board Sophie a few years ago now, the team had already identified a number of herbs of interest, which had been brought together by searching all the available research at the time. And then I looked at that list and added my clinical knowledge of working with herbs every day in my clinic. One of the herbs on the original list was magnolia, not the flower, but the bark. So the bark of the tree is a really important medicine in both the Chinese and Japanese traditions. And it's become quite well known by herbalists in other places around the world now as a really helpful plant to reduce symptoms of anxiety and also mild depression. So magnolia bark itself contains a compound called hinokiol, which is thought to produce its relaxing and calming effect through the GABA pathway. So GABA is a neurotransmitter, you may have heard of it, that's a brain chemical, which is implicated in our ability to feel relaxed and also to get to sleep. And studies have shown that it can potentially impact our serotonin levels as well. And you may well have heard of serotonin, which is another brain chemical implicated in our ability to feel good. And lack of serotonin can contribute to depression, which is why some of the leading pharmaceutical antidepressants work on the serotonin pathway. And you may have heard of those. They're called SSRIs for short. So what I would say is while you're admiring the magnolia tree in your neighborhood and thinking up some recipes for those delicious spring flowers, just remember that in the bark, we can also find a potent and actually really complex medicine with a lot to offer and a really long tradition of use as well. So that's magnolia. And now it's time for our pioneer reflections with Evie. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the discussion with David today.
Yeah, of course. I mean, firstly, listening to you talk today, David, was incredibly inspirational. I mean, I'm just so happy that we kind of have this platform here, you know, just 1 hour a week where we can, you know, give such amazing guests, like we can sit here and listen to, you know, all this amazing information, which, you know, for me, as a 17-year-old, very, very new to the whole medical field, but, you know, I want that to be my future. I honestly feel honoured to be able to just sit back, listen, you know, to people like you share such interesting stories and, like, your whole expertise in such vastly different areas. And it's, like, really opening my eyes to how many options, really, I have for my future professions. So really thank you for being here today to encourage this kind of passion for me, and I'm sure our listeners and pioneers that are going to also be joining me on that journey. And so on today's conversation, I was really interested in how one of your focuses is giving the control back to the patient. It's something that I find is such a beautiful element of palliative care. I just feel like it's missing in almost every element of healthcare. I mean, I myself, in my long-winded story, which I won't get into, but when I was struggling with chronic pain in my legs, all the doctors could really focus on was MRIs and tests, but they never really took the time to have a conversation with how I felt. And I feel like if they did, because overall, that chronic pain was actually caused by mental health kind of issues. So if that was taken into consideration from the very beginning, we could have skipped over a whole long years of different tests. So I think to be able to focus really on a patient and how they're feeling is such an incredible thing that you're doing. So I thank you for that.
Thank you.
Evie, since we have a couple of minutes, do you want to just touch on that example of the chronic pain again for anyone who wasn't listening into the show where you talked about that? Would you mind?
Yeah, of course. Okay.
Yeah, so, just build it out a little bit for us.
So when I was very young, I've always struggled with quite bad anxiety, separation anxiety. I always found going to school very difficult. And this kind of anxiety and just bad mental health state built up to a point where when I was, I think, around 7 years old, I started getting really bad pain in one of my legs. This was like, I was saying to my mum, I can't walk on it. I swear to you, like, I can't walk on it. This then somehow happened to both of my legs. And I was like, okay, I outright cannot walk. Happened to from crutches to wheelchair. Everyone was very, very confused. I was going to tests after tests in UK, in Germany, all over the place, because no one could really figure out what was going on. They're like, there's nothing on the MRI scans. There's every PET scan, every scan we could possibly do, every brain scan, nothing is coming up. But then kind of when I think I went to a neurologist, they were like, listen, this pain is real. This pain is very real, but it's not physically there, which is, of course, very confusing for both my parents and me to hear, because we're like, no, it's real. Trust me, it's real. I'm not crazy. It's not just in my head. But just because it was in my head didn't make it not real, which it's actually something that I find really interesting and I want to explore, because it's just crazy, the power of the mind. But I think if that was explored, you know, if how I was feeling was explored, like kind of what you're doing with palliative care, this whole long-winded process, like I said, could have been reduced to maybe even a month. It could have just been a month of getting that help that I needed, because as soon as the help turned from a more, you know, doctors and just scans and tests over tests to a more, you know, psychiatric based mental help, I could walk within weeks. It took a week and I was on my feet again. So this whole year of outright not being able to walk turned into 1 week of the right help and I could walk again. So I think actually getting to the cause, speaking to a patient, really looking into their background is something that we really need to focus more on in, like, I guess, in the healthcare system. So it's really great that, you know, with palliative care, you're kind of looking more into that. So thank you.
That's a great story. Thanks for sharing. Yeah, the appeal of those tests is really pretty overwhelming. Like, we definitely should spend more time listening and talking with patients, but the appeal of just ordering a test and getting the answer is, it's sort of like going to the end of a book and reading the last couple of paragraphs to find out how it ends. It's hard to convince busy clinicians to slog through all the work of getting there when you could just do a shortcut.
Of course.
But we should.
It sounds like one of the things we've learned through talking with you today, David, is that very holistic approach that you're able to apply in palliative care for very specific reasons, that it would be amazing if some of that was able to be transported into other areas of medicine, maybe. But we also know that there are huge difficulties in doing that. Time, I think, being probably one of the key ones. Vincent, any final thoughts from you today?
Yeah, I was just wondering, David, and, you know, it's actually interesting combining what my question to, you know, what Evie has just, you know, spoken about, because I don't think the two necessarily, you know, help. But hey, I was just sort of thinking, when we're thinking about the Sophie app, we have built a feedback mechanism, right, that allows you to feedback on many different states. Right. And when I heard you talking earlier, David, about, for example, a patient who has nausea, right, and you're trying to give them something, and are you feeling better? Yeah, I think I'm feeling a little bit better. You know, it's those kind of things. And what we've really learned with the Sophie app is actually that, yeah, over time, you can see those things reduce, right? But if you're taking them moment by moment, people find it hard to kind of judge. But if you're asking them over a week's time, right? I don't know, a number from 1 to 10, right? Mm-hmm. How nauseous are you? Then you slowly see that number decrease, for example. Right. And I was sort of thinking that continuous patient feedback, right? You know, how much pain are you in? Are you sleeping well? I don't know. Are you itchy? Right. That whole system that exists. I would think that kind of continuous feedback for doctors is really useful. Right. And it's very useful to kind of like read those charts about patients, how they feel throughout the day, rather than those 10 minutes that they're there. And that's what I was wondering, whether you see something like that happening in mainstream healthcare anytime soon, where you as a patient are basically able to feedback throughout the day on how you're feeling. Or is that just an impossibility and actually not very useful?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's very useful. I think that the challenges are it requires some work on the part of patients to enter data, on the part of clinicians to be open to hearing those data, and on the part of health systems to make it possible for the data that exists in somebody's smartwatch to make it somehow through the ether into an electronic health record system. And I think there are a lot of challenges that various groups are working on trying to work around. I mean, especially going back to the cannabis space, I think that's a perfect example in a way of people who are using medical cannabis to make them feel better. There are apps and platforms out there that let people track whether they are actually feeling better or not and in what way. But the challenge there, and that's sort of a useful use case in a way, because there are millions of people out there in the US alone using medical cannabis, but those results, that data doesn't generally make it into an electronic health record system. So we're relying on patients to look at their own data, to synthesize it, and then to somehow verbalize that, either in person or through a secure message to their healthcare provider. So I think there's progress, but until we get that integration working, it won't be successful because, you know, asking patients to summarize a lot of complex digital data isn't fair to patients, and healthcare providers are busy enough. They're not going to go to another platform to look. So I think we're really waiting on more effective, more efficient, less burdensome integration of some of these solutions with electronic health record systems. I think when that becomes easier and some of those barriers come down, it'll really open the doors to doing exactly what you said, to giving healthcare providers an image that's essentially a mirror of what patients themselves are seeing that can be incorporated into decision-making, ideally with decision aides. You know, if you're taking care of a patient who's experiencing this and this on this set of medications, here's a recommendation for something to try next, particularly if it's something like plant-based medicine that most healthcare providers don't know anything about. Not to try to make most clinicians into herbalists, but at least to give them some skills so we're not woefully ignorant when a patient comes to us and says, you know, they're using licorice root or sawtooth palmetto. And I think most clinicians throw up their hands and say, I have no idea what that is. But I think that connection with data and that connection with recommendations could really help there.
I think that is a really good point, because I think that it's not just the herbs themselves. A lot of clinicians suppose that they can learn the herbs and then do them. Let's do herbs. And yeah. Actually, the practice of herbal medicine is incredibly different because it includes a lot of the holism that you were talking about in palliative care, which is where I see, you know, when you talk about what you do, I see, there we do have things in common there, because that's how we work as well, is to build out how things are for a patient and how their life is. And, you know, it's about looking at the whole of them. So it's not just about doing herbs. It's about doing all of the other stuff as well. It's really, really, really important. Such an interesting conversation. Thank you so much for being with us again today, David, because we know you've literally just come back from speaking at South by Southwest as well. So you must be fairly exhausted. We thank you very much for giving us your time today. It's been a real pleasure to have this conversation with you. Next week, the Sophie team are going to be taking a break and eating a lot of Easter chocolate. So we will not be having a live show on Easter Monday. We're all going to have a rest, but we will be back with you the week after that. So just before we go, a quick reminder of the special portal we've created for UK HR listeners to join Sophie, which is join.sophie.health/radio. Have a wonderful Easter break, and we will see you in 2 weeks' time. Take care.